Hey everyone, welcome to the Fretboard Journal's 95th podcast. This is Jason Verlinde, the publisher of the Fretboard Journal. Thank you so much for tuning in. Thank you so much for subscribing to these via iTunes. Thank you so much for sharing with your friends on Facebook and Twitter and wherever else podcasts are shared. This week we have another highlight from last November's Fretboard Summit. This is a good one. I asked Jim Baggett of Mass Street Music to do a panel discussion on vintage guitar restorations, but also just on vintage guitars in general. He gathered a handful of guys who were also at the summit, including Jay Hostetler of Stumac, Eric Schoenberg, Richard Johnston of Griffin, and Mark Stutman of Folkway Music. And for an hour, as you will hear, they talked about how guitars have been restored over the years, things to think about if you are a guitar collector and need some work done to your guitar, and a lot more. It was a great talk. It's pretty geeky. I think you'll like it. If you've been enjoying the Fretboard Journal podcast, it's probably right up your alley. Before I get to it, I just want to give a huge thank you to Paul Reed Smith and PRS Guitars for sponsoring both our summit videos and our podcast from the summit. PRS had a ton of great instruments at the last NAMM show, the return of the bolt-on neck C24s. They had a couple of baritone models. They always bring out so much. So check out prsguitars.com if you haven't in a while. They have a lot of cool stuff brewing. They did not have a John Mayer signature model guitar, which I think a lot of folks were hoping for, but I know John Mayer has been enjoying his PRSs lately. And Paul gave a talk at the summit, so stay tuned. We're going to try to turn that into a video or a podcast. It's probably going to be a video, and that will be up on fretboardjournal.com hopefully soon. Fretboard Journal 35 is out now. Cindy Cashdollar, Frank Wakefield, Marty Lanham of the Nashville Guitar Company, Banjo Ninja, Danny Barnes are all in that issue. Subscribe at fretboardjournal.com if you haven't yet. We have new packaging for all subscriber copies, and so far the feedback has been exceptional on it. I don't think any postman can do any damage to these anymore. So if you like the Fretboard Journal, if you like the idea of a guitar magazine with barely any ads and some long-form editorial, subscribe to the Fretboard Journal, fretboardjournal.com. Lastly, a lot of folks have been asking about another Fretboard Summit. We will have an announcement in just a couple of weeks that I think you will like if you want another Fretboard Summit. So stay tuned for that. We take everybody's feedback who attended the first one and try to incorporate that. Think about a venue that would work for everyone. Think about some new spaces. We're thinking about programming based on what worked and what didn't work. But it's largely going to be all the things that worked so well at the first Fretboard Summit with some new improvements. Without further ado, here is Jim Baggett leading this great discussion on vintage guitars. We hope you like it. And if there's anything in particular you'd like for us to unveil from the last Fretboard Summit, just shoot me a note at jason@fretboardjournal.com. We are feverishly editing videos and podcasts as well as future issues of the magazine. But we do value your feedback and love the constructive criticism and advice on what we should do next. So drop us a line. Thanks so much.
It was an honor to be invited to do this. And I thought of Mark right away. Mark and I were actually talking at a dinner one time. We just yabbering away about repair and restoration and the right thing to do. And Jason was just seemed fascinated by it. And I think that's really what led to it. So we have Mark Stutzman from Canada, that fabulous repairman and expert on Gibson guitars beyond anybody else that I know. Richard Johnston from Griffin Guitars in Palo Alto, a long history of musical instrument retail, written two books on Martin history. Eric Schoenberg, who's been involved with collectible instruments, kind of brought the OM28 to the forefront many, many years ago as the pick guitar for finger stylists. And Jay Hostetler from Stumac, who, because of Stumac, there's a lot of wonderful knowledge imparted through their videos, through their workshops, through their tools that they offer. They spend a tremendous amount of time bringing things to the marketplace that make it easier for guitar repairmen, luthiers, whatever you want to call it, to do good work. And so I really appreciate that. So any point along the way, feel free to raise your hand and ask a question. But I thought we'd kind of start off with by talking about the relatively short history that we have with the modern acoustic guitar. Really, the modern steel string acoustic guitar as we know it kind of blossom in the early 30s. And so you have less than 100 years compared to the violin business, which has been doing repair and restoration for hundreds of years. You would never find an old violin that hasn't had an amazing amount of work done to it. And it doesn't, if it's done properly, it can add value to it. And who did it and who wrote the papers, is an important thing. Who put the new neck on it? Who put the bass bar in it? Those are things that our little industry didn't have in the early days. No Martin came with a manual to tell you how to fix it, how to take the neck off. And we were talking about this, an early memo from Mike Longworth, who was an early Martin historian, said the Martin neck is not made to be removed. You have to either shave the fretboard down or shave the bridge down. It's a permanent joint. So we all know that that's not true nowadays because we've all taken a million necks off and made these instruments into so that where they play like modern instruments. I'm sure that each one of us has a little something to say. So I'm going to turn it. We might as well start from one side to the other and interrupt any time. Ask questions. That's why we're here. Mark.
Hi. I'll just piggyback on your Martin necks are not made to be taken apart, and we now know how to take them apart. But there's great variety in the quality of workmanship that goes into taking them apart and putting them back together. So yeah, we technically know how to take them apart, but I think one of the things that I would love to discuss about with us is there some way of assuring the quality of the work that you're going to get from repair person X? Is that something that we need to concern ourselves with? Is a neck set a neck set? Is a new bridge, et cetera, et cetera? It's just when we started talking about this particular talk, we didn't really have an idea of where we were going to go with it and what exactly was going to come out of our mouths and what we were going to discuss and what we're not going to discuss. But this, for me, as a person who does repair and who spends a lot of time undoing other people's repair work, previous repair work, maybe it's 50-year-old repair work, maybe it's 3-week-old repair work. Where we are today is very different than where we have been in the past, even personally. I mean, I've undone my own work that I did 15 years ago that I wasn't pleased with. So is that something that...
Yes, you know, so some of the stuff that I did 15 years ago, I really don't want to see.
Well, for instance, Frank Ford, my business partner, and I built some guitars, and we didn't know we were going to be needing to steam the neck joints out, so we didn't leave any gap at the bottom of the dovetail. So there's no air pocket that you can drill into and inject steam to loosen the joint. So people will bring in, you know, boy, I'll bet you guys are glad to see this. No, we're not. And, well, you'll do a neck reset, right? No, we won't. And it's just, those guitars are a snapshot in time. And one of the things is that if you could turn back to, you know, the clock to say 1970, and I'm sure Eric will second me on this, there was no information at all. The only two books out were the Irving Sloan book and A.P. Sharp's How to Build a Classical Guitar. There were virtually no books on repair until Hideo Kamimoto's came out. And Martin wasn't taking necks out. Virtually nobody was using animal hide glue for repairs at all. And it was the Wild West. We did what we felt we needed to do to keep the guitars on the road, and it's easy to judge things, you know, from the past by today's standards, and that can be very short-sighted because it's the amount of information. I mean, not to mention the fact that in 1970 there was no internet, so the combination of the Stumac catalog and all the websites you can find with photos and detailed instructions of how to do things. And then just the vast amount of knowledge—it's a very different world 45 years later.
Well, as an example, 50 years ago, not 15, but 50, I bought a 12-fret 00045 from George Gruen for $600 because it had a bowed neck, and he didn't know how to fix it. And I was working with Mark Silber at the time, took it to him. I mean, there was nobody in New York at the time who could fix this guitar, which would be a very simple repair right now. Mark said, I think you should take it to Martin, which I did with trepidation, but those were small company in the old days. I visited them several times, and they'd pull the guitar out, and we'd talk about it. And they came back playing beautifully, and it's true, their line was, the neck don't come out. But, you know, we got this guitar back, and I brought it to Matt Ivanoff to inlay the first fret inlay, which they had planed through. And he says he stayed up all night staring at this guitar. Oh, thank you. Trying to figure out what the hell did they do. And we looked at it really carefully and figured out that, one, they reset the neck. So they certainly knew that you could, but did not want to admit it because they'd have thousands and thousands of guitars they'd have to reset for free. And, you know, I had to redo some of those repairs. I mean, I asked for little frets, and they didn't work, and a few things like that. But that's a good example of where we were all at. West Coast timing might be a little bit different because you had John Lundberg, but New York, you know, and this is Gruen down south, is long before he had his business. But we've come a hell of a long way now from then.
Yeah, and we wrestle with this all the time because obviously we create the tools that go out to everyone, whether amateur or professional, and do the work. And we realize, to address Mark's question, we don't know how qualified some of the people are that use those tools, but the demand is there. Obviously, people want to learn, so on top of that, we try to do the videos and the books to teach you how to do the work. But obviously, in the last 30, 40 years, this has changed dramatically due to the price points of the guitars, the vintage market, which we're going to talk about in a little bit. I don't have an answer for Mark for your question about how do you qualify. I mean, how do you qualify your electrician, your plumber, even your surgeon who went to school? And they're not all great.
There are colleges for those professions. They're professionally regulated.
But not all of them are good.
Still no guarantee at all.
There's no guarantee. So you got to ask questions to people who have gone to the repairman and talk it out and now get online and learn about it. Not so much from the forums. Those are dangerous. We watch those. But
agreed.
There's a lot of information that shouldn't be on there.
Yep.
But more information than ever is out there, and as we were also talking earlier, we are kicking around, and Joe Glazer is kicking around some way of creating a database of photos of old guitars. You can see the repair work. You can know what is the proper peg head even on a guitar, just to help identify them and help see what work is done. That would be a vast improvement.
Yeah.
Well, but
go ahead.
One of the problems, I mean, the internet swings both ways. So one of the difficulties with the fact that there's essentially no accreditation for, you know, for repairmen is there certainly is no accreditation for what you can post on a forum. And so there's a lot of misinformation. A lot of it comes from people who are very active on forums. And people figure, well, he's made 2,500 posts. He must know what he's talking about. Frequently, there's an inverse ratio between the number of posts someone puts up and the amount of qualified information that they dispense. So, for instance, we recently sold a very expensive electric guitar, and the owner of the guitar stipulated, he says, you know, do not put this on your website. I don't want photos of my guitar being posted on a forum where a bunch of idiots take pot shots at it and then scares people away because people are making claims about what's been done to it, and those claims are untrue. So there's an increase, and I think Eric will second this, that there's an increasing number of sales of high-end guitars that essentially have to go under the radar. You can't post them. It's not because there's anything wrong with the guitar. It's that once the guitar gets into that you know, that mudslinging foray on certain forums, which shall remain nameless, it can be very difficult to get anyone to believe, you know, what any of us would probably say has been done, what the guitar is, where the guitar came from, and so on. So having, you know, getting some accreditation for repairmen is going to be really important, but also, like I say, it's just as a word of warning, the internet has a lot of great information. The internet has a lot of absolute garbage.
There's
about
a lot
guitar
of,
repair.
There's a lot of accredited opinionators on the forum, and these are people who are very well known or in the business, who also have given bad advice.
Yeah, one of from the mouth of Richards, one of my favorite quotes is, "The only thing worse than being wrong on the forum is being right." And Mark and I were talking earlier. I think Mark, being the youngest up here, understands the whole social media world a lot better, and he's going to talk to us about that some. Getting back to repair, one important thing is with the value of instruments as they have gone up, like Jay was saying, it's created opportunities for really qualified, really great craftsmen to come into the field. They can make a living with it now. Instead of doing a neck set for $150, they do a neck set for $1,200 because the guitar is $30,000. So there are opportunities. So between the opportunities that are out there, the shared knowledge amongst repairmen, and also having someone to go to. You can go to repair workshops. You meet people at, one of my repairmen just went to a Gallup workshop and he came back so excited about it. He learned a lot of things. One of the important things is he learned that there was a lot he didn't know. So he's on the curve. He did, you know, there are opportunities. Every one of us, if we have a question, we'll call your friend. Calls another great repairman. I call Ken Fallon. I call Mark. I call Dennis Burke. There's some really great repair people in the world nowadays. And if you are a customer looking for a great repairman, shop around. Talk to people. See what other people say. You know, and I mean, I've sent people to all, you know, even though I do restoration myself, I've sent them to, if they ask for a recommendation, they say, "What do you think about Ken Fallon?" I go, "He's fabulous." You know, "What do you think of Mark?" "He's fabulous." So get some recommendations from people, and find someone, ask questions, increase your knowledge as a customer of repair people, or if you want to get into the field of repair, make acquaintances of all of the people that are out there. Go to workshops, look at the Stumac catalog, look at the information, and you'll grow.
And most importantly, depending on the value of your guitar, figure out what you want and communicate that with the person doing the repair. Are you planning on playing the guitar regularly? Do you want to use it as a musical instrument? Do you want to, you know, travel with it or do whatever? Or, because if you're buying guitars primarily as investment, you need to give that information to the repairman, so that he knows, okay, this guitar has a really chewed up bridge plate from, you know, hundreds and hundreds of string changes and thousands of string balls bouncing up against it. But this guy, you know, in the current climate, altering a bridge plate is something that a lot of people are critical of. And so if you're not going to be changing strings every week, maybe you just want that person, the repairman, to do as little as possible to the bridge plate to avoid having, you know, getting a lot of criticism for it. But if you're going to be using the guitar for a significant period of time, if you're 40 years old and you're looking at another 25 years of active guitar playing and you like the guitar and you want to use it, you may need to have a little bit more aggressive restoration of the underside of the bridge done so that you don't crack the bridge. Because, you know, string balls pull through the bridge plate, pull through the top because it's soft spruce, pull up against the, you know, the ebony bridge and crack it between the pins. So there can be downsides to trying to do as little as possible. And if you're going to be playing the guitar all the time, I don't know, I would imagine Mark would like to know that, as opposed to somebody that already has 15 guitars like that, and this is the latest trophy.
Well, then, and as another part of that is if you decide to do that, and you know that it was documented, that it was done by Mark or Ken Fallon or TJ, that should add confidence that it was done properly. And there's I only use those names because that's came to the top of my head. All of us know very good repairmen, and their work, we will come to a time when these guitars will have to be worked on, and the work should add value. It can add value by the knowledge of who did it. It can add value by documentation of it as it's done. Like a violin. You get a violin, it comes with Hill & Son papers, and it tells you all that's been done to this thing. The grafting, the fringe polish work, the change of the bass bar, the grafted scroll. People are excited to get it because it's fabulous. All that work was done because the instrument was worth it.
A very good example of that would be the contention over a replaced bridge plate or a replaced bridge. These days, there's a lot of those forumites who will tell you that that's a no-no, whereas it's often the proper way to repair and improve an instrument. So the one bit of doubt when you have replaced parts like that is, what happened to the top underneath those parts?
Take a picture.
Right. I buy that guitar, it has had its bridge plate replaced, and then it folds up under the bridge because it turns out that whoever took off the other bridge plate pulled a lot of wood out. There's a lot of wood missing. There's a lot of things that could be hidden because that's one of the most sensitive part of repair.
Eric, can I interject just for a moment? It's a very valid point, and I think your idea of having a photographic legacy to go with a guitar is absolutely brilliant, particularly on a guitar, a Martin with a tucked bridge plate, for example. It's the easiest way to ruin a Martin guitar is to change that bridge plate if you don't know what you're doing. And the easiest way to ruin a Martin guitar is to put a bridge plate in there without filling those gaps under the axe.
Right. Photos would be...
How do you know? And that's why I'm a repair person, but I also buy and sell guitars for a living. And if I see a Martin guitar that's got a bridge plate replacement, and it's from that very long era where the axe was lapping the bridge plate, I often don't buy it. Because I'm a little scared of that. I'm not going to sell something that I think is maybe substandard in terms of its long-term life cycle.
But as Jim was just saying, that in the violin world, that's okay. So are we going to get through that with guitars? And it's funny we're talking about this because we have a tool called the Bridge Saver. Something that Dan Erlewine came up. It's a little conical piece, very minimal on the bridge plate. But we've been told by a couple of other repair guys that they don't like to see that done because that hurts the originality of the guitar and they think it loses its value. But they're just trying to make it playable. So do you replace the bridge plate? Do you use the Bridge Saver? Do you fill it?
Are you talking about the plug?
Yeah, the little plug.
Yeah, the early wine plugs.
Well,
yeah.
There's a very specific thing of contention I got in with a very highly respected repair person who claimed if you did that, you're hurting the tone of the guitar. And this is a person who has expressed
that might be
that
a can
opinion.
Of worms we don't want to open too
yeah,
much.
I don't think we want to go there.
but we can
but
say
that's one bit of advice I will say, not to listen to.
Well, Jay, I have to tell you that forum experts have told me that the plugs that the Dan Erlewine system uses are at least twice to three times larger than they should be, and I said, well, if you make the plug much smaller, it's going to be about the same size as the hole that the bridge pin needs, and the string ball is just going to suck up the plug the first time you change the strings. So,
do you use sawdust and super glue? At some point, you've got to do something to make it
playable.
It's
the million ways to skin a cat argument, for sure. And ultimately, if the customer's needs are served properly, you ultimately did your job. It doesn't matter if someone else decides that the way you did it was wrong. I mean, it's kind of a tough one. Who's God here? Who gets
well,
designed?
And it goes right into the title of this talk, The Evolution of Repair. that evolved, and it was a really great way to solve it. If the next level comes up with a better way to do it, if the craftspeople, the customers have demands for something else, it will change. It will grow. Stumac will come up with the next system. And it's an incredible source that they have the things that they have to help us do things.
Which is not just us. It's you guys throwing ideas back to us. So
yeah.
We can talk about the technology. I mean, it's a bit of a good segue to look at the technology that's evolving and how we're using it for guitar repair, which I know is something that you did want to discuss. In terms of bridge plates in particular, mm-hmm. You guys are now selling those Thompson belly reducers, which, if used properly, do amazing things to reduce the need for a bridge plate replacement. I've taken out bridge plates that were completely ruined, I thought were ruined in the past, before that or my own modification of that kind of tool arrived on my particular scene. Bridge plates that were pulled right, the bridge was lifting off the top and it was strung at pitch for 100 years, and the bridge plate, instead of being flat, you know, was shaped like a mountain. You can save those bridge plates now if you need to. I mean, sure, on my own guitar I might not choose to do that, but I can.
Right.
And the technology is there, but...
Well, part of what we're dealing with, just so you know, is that guitars really aren't made to be taken apart. Violins are. A violin is constructed with weakened hot animal hide glue holding the top, the soundboard, to the ribs, and there's no binding. And so if you know what you're doing and you're using the right tools, you can take the top off a violin and change the bass bar or do a reinforcement for the dreaded soundpost crack, which generally kills most violins. You can get in there and get back out again, and it's very difficult to tell that you were there. That you can't do that with a guitar with celluloid binding around the edges, and there's lots of things about guitars where the design of the instrument just wasn't done with long-term thinking about, okay, how is somebody going to take this neck out in the future? For instance, there's those wonderful moments when you are trying to take a neck out of a guitar and you discover that it went back to the factory because the top was damaged, and the factory replaced the top, and they put the top right over the opening of the dovetail joint, so there's no way you can get the neck out until you take the fingerboard off and cut through the section of top that shouldn't have been there. And it's obvious that when they repaired it, it was, we're done. Goodbye.
There's been a lot of guitars ruined that way.
Yeah.
In other people's shops.
I was going to ask Mark to comment. All of us know the bad side of social media and all the misinformation that's out there. Mark was mentioning, I think there's some positive sides to it, and he's probably way ahead of us by being 20 years younger.
Yeah, so, and I should be 20 years younger than myself to be really ahead of it. But no, I mean, I've been using social media mostly as a marketing tool, and call spade a spade, but it's great for sharing, and I photograph all the repairs I do with my phone. It's always sitting next to me anyways. It used to be that I would pull out my big SLR and get my lights out, and so I didn't photograph anything. It was a pain in the butt. But now with my iPhone, I just stick it in the guitar. Or I can take pictures of anything and everything, and I do. And if I'm doing something that's particularly interesting, I'll put a picture of that on Folkways' Instagram site or feed and explain what I'm doing. And say, hey, this is kind of cool. I just invented this. Check it out. And by the same token, there's so many people, many of whom we've never, ever, ever heard of, who are doing really cool things in their basement with guitars. Maybe you've never heard of this particular guy, but he's got a really, really interesting way of dealing with, this particular kind of repair that, maybe there is no set standard way to deal with. And he posts a picture of it, and wow, that's really cool. I'm going to try that. And so there's a growing community of social media repair people who are showing off what they do. And some of what people show off really shouldn't be shown off. There's no question. I would say maybe the gross majority. But they're still showing it off, and they're still opening themselves up to comment. And as long as we each take our own sort of job seriously and take our responsibility seriously and say, you know what, buddy, like, maybe that's not a great idea in a nice way. This is how I do it. maybe they'll learn, and the community of sharing really grows. And I have to say, I think I'm a pretty good repair guy, but I don't have all the answers. And if someone shows me some system they have for something, and it strikes a chord with me, so to speak, I'm super stoked about it. It's great to find a new technique. So there's a future there. There's lots of people we haven't heard of that are going to teach us lots of things.
Well, one of the things that that Frank Ford has commented on many times, because he teaches at Roberto Van and all that stuff, and what we run into quite frequently, is that sometimes it's not so much how the repair, whether the proper technique was used, but whether the person doing the repair is really good at how they've decided to deal with a problem. And so when you say, well, wait a minute, this wasn't done the right way, many times when someone tries to do something in the approved method for the first time, it doesn't work. And yeah, so it's skill. Yeah, and so frequently when somebody's been doing something for 30 years, they can be really good at it. It might be a method that isn't particularly popular today, but they're so good at doing it the way they've been doing it for the last 30 years that it's best to, let them do it. It's gonna come out fine. I mean, we're still arguing about refrets. You know, there's guys that do the glued-in frets, you know, the wide fret slots, things like that. The guys at Huss and Dalton do it really well. they don't want to do press fit refrets. But for the rest of us, the first time you try to do an epoxy glued fret job, it's like, ha 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 ha, you know, that's a nightmare. So again, it's just, you know, what do you do? How often do you do it? What kind of success rate have you had? And there's lots of different ways to do stuff.
And back to the social media, are you mainly talking Instagram? Because that seems to be the friendliest, easiest.
I'm not a social media guru. I'm really far from that. But I use Instagram, and it feeds automatically to my Facebook feed, and so I can contact people both ways.
Yeah, we found Instagram to be the...
It's great.
It's great. I don't know, there's something about it that works much better than the other places.
They'll figure out a way to make it certainly not great soon and charge us for it.
But if you're not
following, for the time being.
There are a lot of guitar people on it, just showing off new guitars and repair work, so it's fun to follow.
Yeah.
Here I am learning new things.
That's great. They'll soon have an Instagram handle.
I was going to mention one other thing that I kind of had in my notes, and I'd like to open it up to questions, and let's see. Other guys have stuff to add to it. One is that part of the evolution of restoration is going to be that once I'm in a nursing home and I'm done with it, these beautiful guitars that are being made by all the great luthiers of today, their instruments will have things that will be change in them that will need restoration. And they have the opportunity to let you know, the modern repairman has a way of tracking back, going, oh yeah, well they use this kind of glue between 1979 and 1993, so if you're taking a neck off from that era, that's what you should do. If it's coming in from this, from 1993 to 2010, they changed a little bit. So those instruments are going to be the vintage guitars of the future. They're going to be the valuable guitars of the future. And I think there's a great opportunity for the next generation of repairmen to track that and know and have knowledge of how to properly address the issues that will show up. Guitars change. You know, there's a lot of tension on a guitar, and they're subjected to all kinds of environments. They will need proper care.
I'd say the responsibility should lie on the manufacturer or builder to be influenced by the repairmen of today.
Good luck with that.
To include all that important information. What kind of neck joint, what kind of glue,
absolutely,
et cetera.
I couldn't agree more. Yeah.
You got some influence there. You can you can use it.
We all agree on that. Do you guys have any questions?
Can I get in on that one? No. No. Unfortunately, manufacturing technology has made a lot of parts of new guitars very hard to repair. There's a lot of phenomenal new guitars that, for example, bridges that the bottom of the bridge is indexed into a recess in the finish so that it locks in place when they're gluing it, and you have wood-to-wood glue without needing to clear the finish away from the entire bridge footprint. Those bridges don't usually come off, modern glues and great joints and excellent workmanship. But if they do come off, it's a lot of work.
The other way.
You know, or like modern, I'll just use an example of Martin. We all love Martin guitars, but we can bash them a little bit. An old Martin guitar that didn't have an adjustable truss rod also didn't have an extra hole in the neck block for all your steam to escape when you're trying to take the neck apart. And if you go to try to take a neck apart on a herringbone D28 built, you know, recently, and you put your steam needle in there, the steam goes everywhere but where you want it to go. And they're using this crazy space glue. I don't know what it is, tight bond or some crazy non-hide glue kind of glue that steam doesn't take apart very easily. So you can destroy one of those guitars if you're not careful.
Peter Cooper's PV2.
There you go. Thank you. How do you take that apart? I don't know. You know, but no, there are certain guitars certainly that are being built in a traditional kind of way that are still the same guitars to take apart as, you know, 1952, you know, 0018, but a modern instrument, a lot of it, no, they're not easier to.
And they have a UV finish, which adds a whole other dimension.
Right.
Wait, did you have a question?
Yeah, actually, this is for a gentleman.
Mystery object.
Yeah, well, you know, it's like, oh, what am I going to do with this? I already gave mine to Joe McNamara. Not me. But my question for you is, one of the things in the goodie bag is this long, translucent piece of plastic shaped like a fingerboard, and then there's this little pad there.
It's a fret shield. It goes in between the frets and the strings. Tom Anderson started using that years ago, so when you're shipping your guitar somewhere, you can slide that in there so it doesn't actually damage, the strings don't damage the frets. I guess it needs an instruction sheet with it. Thank you.
Yeah. They'll just have to get the catalog,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Look it up online.
Yes.
You didn't buy it in Canada, then.
And some of these guys have, you know, a large number of guitars because our small cabinet holds three or four. We've tried to go out and find, you know, bits and pieces off of the guitar manufacturers' websites to kind of point them to our customers that describe, you know, what you need to do. But it'd be really helpful if there was a document out there that, you know, talk to how do you care for the guitar and how do you know when it needs work and what are the right questions to ask the repair person that you take it to. Is there any kind of documentation out there that you could point us to that would help with that?
You mean whether one manufacturer's guitar needs to be at one humidity level and another manufacturer's guitar needs to be in another?
Because
basically they all fall within the same range. In other words, if you keep guitars at 45%. You know, you're going to be fine if you can avoid going significantly below 35 and significantly above 55. They're going to be fine.
Taylor and Martin guitars come with document as such.
Yeah, Taylor's come with a lot of it.
A lot of it.
And ironically, a lot of that information is aimed not so much at the consumer but at the dealer.
Dealer's responsibility, in my opinion. Again, being in Canada where this is a real issue.
Yeah.
The dealer, you know. Yeah, you teach your client about that when you take a guitar. And we give a free humidifier with every guitar we sell. We're in Canada. It's kind of commonplace. And we, you know, we eat the $10 cost. There you go. And they don't come back with a crack and yell at us. And we teach them how to use it. It's the dealer's responsibility. The same way it used to be the dealer's responsibility to adjust a nut on a guitar before they sold it to you, and nobody did. This is the same thing that nobody's also doing.
I tell customers that the humidifier is kind of like birth control. If you don't use it, you're in for a surprise.
But unlike birth control, you can overuse the humidifier, and then you're in for another surprise.
That's it.
It's a great idea.
I think it's a fabulous thing. I think to have documentation, just like a violin, comes with, the first thing that somebody says, I have a real Amati, you say, show me the paperwork. You want to see it. You want to know. I have, you know, and I think the paperwork adds value, and I think paperwork following fine guitars is in the next evolution of what we're attempting to do. And I think it'd be wonderful to have it. And if you have it, doesn't mean you necessarily need to share it with everybody, but it's your assurance. It should bring assurance that, yes, this neck was reset by my favorite repairman. The bridge plate was replaced. I have photo documentation of the surface underneath the bridge plate. We felt that it was necessary. The bridge is replaced, but it's exactly the same size, or it's oversized, whatever the situation may be. You have a document that gives you assurance of what you have. I think we're headed that way.
Or every guitar. I mean, every certain price point on guitar.
Not so much a warranty manual, but...
No, I mean...
History.
Logbook.
It would
be great. And and especially now that there are so many really good repairmen out there, you can say, I'm not going to name names because there's so many good people. And if you're a good enough repairman to say, here's a document of the work that I did on this guitar, you sign your name on that, and, you know, it goes with the guitar, and hopefully there will come a time when that will add value and confidence to the guitar.
Here's an addition. In regard to newer technology, we can measure the thickness of the wood with a couple of devices, and I think it would be nice for that logbook to contain that information. If you get an old guitar that's been refinished, the one thing you need to know is, was there wood removed and how much?
And how long did they leave the sander on?
Exactly right.
That's another shade of gray that's difficult, particularly in my world of working on lots of Gibsons, where the variability in top thickness could be 50% from the factory.
Martin too, from some periods.
Oh, yeah.
Nitrocellulose finish repair
is not fun.
It seems like the higher the price of the instrument, the more you try to do less to the instrument. I personally kind of like working with nitro. It's, you know, it does blend with its former, with the old finishes. Everything in restraint. Less is more is my motto. With all kinds of finish work, because finish doesn't add tone to the instrument.
Mark, go ahead. Well, but one reminder, a lot of people, you know, nitrocellulose finish is really popular, and a lot of people want guitars finished with nitrocellulose. But in defense of manufacturers that are going with the new, the UV cure finishes, please remember that if you buy Sherwin-Williams, you know, water white lacquer today, that's not the same formula that Martin was using in the 1930s or even in the early 1960s. You can't use the kind of finishes that you used back then because of the VOC requirements, the Clean Air Act. I mean, one of the things we have to remember is that a lot of the manufacturing techniques that were used back in the good old days were really disastrous for the environment. For instance, plating. You can't get a new National guitar with a nickel-plated surface that doesn't fingerprint the way the old National guitars, you know, resist fingerprints. Well, the stuff they were dumping in the rivers back when they were plating those tricones was, you know, I mean, you could kill half of Los Angeles County. So, you know, we just have to accept the fact that times have changed. When you paint your house, you're not painting your house with stuff that's nearly as long-lasting as it was. It doesn't have, paint doesn't have lead in it. lead's great for making paint flow and making it last, but for Christ's sakes, we don't want to have it on our houses anymore.
I have a question about the UV finishes, the poly UV, or repairing that. What is a practical way, if somebody damages one of those, that y'all could, you know, fix that or at least make it, you know, serviceable?
I try to encourage people to live with it.
That's the best option.
It can't. There are ways to repair it. Taylor's very good at repairing it. Yeah. It's tricky. I would recommend that someone, you know, go to Taylor and, you know, they'll spend a couple of hours teaching you how to do it. But of course that's Taylor's UV finish. I don't know if it works as well with another manufacturer.
Well,
there may well be, and there's repairmen that may want to specialize or not specialize in that. Personally, I have no really desire to have that be one of my merit badges.
There,
I think we're about out of time. I'm sure that any of us and all of us would be glad to talk the rest of the afternoon about this stuff because we are passionate about it. We do love it, and we're so glad that you guys showed up.
Thanks
so much for coming. Does anybody else have anything?
Thank you all so much.
Yep, thanks for coming.